by the London press, Hobbins & Co., in August 1913. The volume sold well and received favourable reviews. The Times described the stories as a strange delight that enlivened in this reviewer the enchanting and sometimes frightening sensations of childhood. The illustrations by Nathaniel Walker were praised especially and are thought by some to rank amongst his best work. 1. See Thomas R. Collins, Sketching the Past, Hamilton Hudson, 1959, and Reginald Coit, Famous Illustrators, Wycliffe Press, 1964. They were a departure from the oil portraits, for which he is now better remembered. Eliza's own story began on the 1st of September, 1888, when she was born in London. The birth records for that year indicate that she was born a twin, and the first 12 years of her life were spent in a tenement house at No. 35 Battersea Church Road. Eliza's pedigree is rather more complex than her humble origins might suggest. Her mother, Georgiana, was the daughter of an aristocratic family, inhabitants of Blackhurst Manor in Cornwall. Georgiana Mountrachet caused a society scandal when, at the age of 17, she ran away from the family estate with a young man far beneath her own social class. Eliza's father, Jonathan Makepeace, was born in London in 1866 to a penniless Thames bargeman and his wife. He was the fifth of nine children and grew up in the slums behind the London docks. Although his death in 1888 occurred before Eliza was born, Eliza's published tales seem to reinterpret events that were likely experienced by a young Jonathan Makepeace during his childhood on the river. For instance, in The River's Curse, the dead men hanging from the fairy gallows are almost certainly based on scenes Jonathan Makepeace would have witnessed as a boy at Execution Dock. We must presume that these stories were passed to Eliza through her mother, Georgiana, embellished perhaps, and stored in Eliza's memory until she began to write herself. How the son of a poor London bargeman came to meet and fall in love with the high-born Georgiana Mountrachet remains a mystery. In line with the secretive nature of her elopement, Georgiana left no information about events leading to her departure. Attempts to learn the truth are further thwarted by her family's diligent efforts to smother the story. There was very little coverage in the newspapers, and one must search further afield, in contemporary letters and diaries, to find mention of what must surely have been a great scandal at the time. The occupation listed on Jonathan's death certificate is sailor. However, the precise nature of his employment is unclear. It is speculation only that leads this writer to suggest that perhaps Jonathan's life on the seas brought him briefly to the rocky shores of Cornwall. That perhaps, on the cove of her family's estate, Lord Mountrachet's daughter, famed throughout the county for her flame-haired beauty, chanced to meet the young Jonathan Makepeace. Whatever the circumstances of their meeting, that they were in love cannot be doubted. Alas, the young couple were not to be granted years of happiness. Jonathan's sudden and somewhat inexplicable death, less than 10 months after their elopement, must have dealt a devastating blow to Georgiana Mountrachet, who was left alone in London, unwed, pregnant, and with neither family nor financial security. Georgiana was not one to flounder, however. She had abandoned the strictures of her social class and, after the birth of her babies, abandoned, too, the name of Mountrachet. She performed copywork for the legal firm of H.J. Blackwater & Associates of Lincoln's Inn, Holborn. There is some evidence that Georgiana's fine penmanship was a gift for which she found ample expression in her youth. The Mountrachet family journals, donated in 1950 to the British Library, contain a number of playbills composed with careful lettering and accomplished illustrations. In the corner of each playbill, the artist has written her name in tiny print. Amateur theatricals were, of course, popular in many of the great houses. However, the playbills for those at Blackhurst in the 1880s occur with greater regularity and seriousness than was perhaps usual. Little is known of Eliza's childhood in London, other than the house in which she was born and spent her early years. One can posit, however, that her life was governed by the dictates of poverty and the difficult business of survival. In all probability, the tuberculosis that would be Georgiana's ultimate killer was already stalking her in the mid-1890s. If her condition followed the common path, by the latter years of the decade, breathlessness and general weakness would have precluded regular work. Certainly, the accounts for H.J. Blackwater support this timetable of decline. There is no evidence that Georgiana sought medical attention for her illness, but fear of medical intervention was common in the period. During the 1880s, TB was made a notifiable disease in Britain, and medical practitioners were bound by law to report instances of the illness to government authorities. Members of the urban poor, frightened of being sent to sanatoriums, which more usually resembled prisons, were loath to seek help. Her mother's illness must have had a great effect on Eliza, both practically and creatively. It is almost certain that she would have been required to contribute financially to the household. Girls in Victorian London were employed in all manner of menial positions, domestic servants, fruit sellers, flower girls, and Eliza's depiction of mangles and hot tubs in some of her fairy tales suggests that she was intimately acquainted with the task of laundering. The vampire-like beings in The Fairy Hunt may also reflect the early 19th century belief that sufferers of consumption were vampire-afflicted. Sensitivity to bright light, swollen red eyes, very pale skin, and the characteristic bloody cough were all symptoms that fed this belief. Whether Georgiana made any attempt to contact her family after Jonathan's death, and as her own health deteriorated, is unknown. However, in this writer's opinion, it seems unlikely. Certainly, a letter from Linus Mountrachet to an associate, dated December 1900, suggests that he had only recently learned of Eliza, his little London niece, and was shocked to think that she had passed a decade in such terrible conditions. Perhaps Georgiana feared that the Mountrachet family might be unwilling to forgive her original desertion. If her brother's letter is anything to go by, such fear was unfounded. After so many long years spent searching abroad, trawling the seas and scouring the lands, to think my beloved sister was so near all along, and allowing herself to suffer such privations. You will see that I spoke truth when I told you of her nature, how little she seemed to care that we loved her so, and longed only for her safe homecoming. Though Georgiana never made such a homecoming, Eliza was destined to return to the bosom of her maternal family. Georgiana Mountrachet died in June 1900, when Eliza was 11. The death certificate names her killer as consumption, and her age as 30. After her mother's death, Eliza was sent to live with her mother's family on the Cornish coast. It is unclear how this family reunion was affected, but one can safely assume that, despite the unfortunate circumstances precipitating it, for the young Eliza, this change of location was a most fortunate occurrence. Relocation to Blackhurst Manor, with its grand estate and gardens, must have been a welcome relief, offering safety after the dangers of the London streets. Indeed, the sea became a motif of renewal and possible redemption in her fairy tales. Eliza is known to have lived with her maternal uncle's family until the age of 25. However, her whereabouts thereafter remain a mystery. Various theories have been formulated as to her life after 1913, though all are yet to be proved. Some historians suggest that she most likely fell victim to the spread of scarlet fever that enveloped the Cornish coast in 1913. Others, perplexed by the 1936 publication of her final fairy tale, The Cuckoo's Flight, in the journal Literary Lives, suggest that she spent her time travelling, seeking the life of adventure championed by her fairy tales. This tantalizing idea is yet to receive any serious academic attention, and, despite such theories, the fate of Eliza Makepeace, along with the date of her death, remains one of literature's mysteries. There exists a charcoal sketch of Eliza Makepeace, drawn by the well-known Edwardian portrait artist Nathaniel Walker. Found after his death amongst his unfinished works, the sketch, entitled The Authoress, hangs currently in the Tate Gallery in London. Although Eliza Makepeace published only one complete collection of fairy tales, her work is rich in metaphorical and sociological texture and would reward scholarship. Where earlier tales like The Changeling show a strong influence from the European fairy tale tradition, later tales like The Crone's Eyes suggest a more original and, one would venture, autobiographical approach. However, like many female writers of the first decade of this century, Eliza Makepeace fell victim to the cultural shift that occurred after the momentous world events of the early century, the First World War and women's suffrage, to name but two, and slipped from readers' attention. Many of her stories were lost during the Second World War, when the British Library was robbed of entire runs of its more obscure periodicals. As a consequence, Eliza and her fairy tales are relatively unknown today. Her work, along with the author herself, seems to have disappeared from the face of the earth, lost to us, like so many other ghosts of the early decades of the century. Chapter 14. London, 1900. High above Mr. and Mrs. Swindle's rag and bottle shop, in their narrow house by the Thames, there was a tiny room. Little more than a closet, really. It was dark and damp, with a fusty smell. The natural consequence of poor drainage and non-existent ventilation. Discoloured walls that cracked in summer and seeped through winter. And a fireplace whose chimney had been blocked so long it seemed churlish to suggest it should be otherwise. Yet despite its meanness, the room above the Swindle shop was the only home Eliza Makepeace and her twin brother Sammy had ever known, a modicum of safety and security in lives otherwise devoid of both. They had been born in the autumn of London's fear, and the older Eliza grew, the more certain she became that this fact, above any other, made her what she was. The Ripper was the first adversary in a life that would be filled with them. The thing Eliza liked best about the room upstairs, indeed the only thing she liked beyond its bare status as shelter, was the crack between two bricks, high above the old pine shelf. She was eternally grateful that the slapdashery of a long-ago builder, combined with the tenacity of the local rats, had begot a nice fat gap in the mortar. If Eliza lay flat on her stomach, stretched herself right along the shelf with her eye pressed close against the bricks and her head cocked just so, she could glimpse the nearby bend of the river. From such secret vantage point, she was able to watch unobserved as the tide of busy daily life ebbed and flowed. Thus were Eliza's twin ideals achieved. She was able to see, yet not be seen. For though her own curiosity knew no bounds, Eliza didn't like to be watched. She understood that to be noticed was dangerous, that certain scrutiny was akin to thieving. Eliza knew this because it was what she most liked to do, store images in her mind to be replayed, revoiced, recolored as she pleased. To weave them into wicked stories, flights of fancy that would have horrified the people who'd provided unwitting inspiration. And there were so many people to choose from. Life on Eliza's bend of the Thames never stopped. The river was London's lifeblood, swelling and thinning with the ceaseless tides, transmitting the beneficent and the brutal alike, in and out of the city. Although Eliza liked it when the coal boats came in at high water, the watermen rowing people back and forth, the lighters bringing in cargo from the colliers. It was low tide when the river really came to life. When the levels dropped sufficiently for Mr. Hackman and his son to start dragging for bodies whose pockets needed clearing, when the mudlarks took up position, scouring the stinking mud for rope and bones and copper nails, anything they could find that might be swapped for coin. Mr. Swindle had his own team of mudlarks and his own patch of mud, a putrid square he kept guarded as if it contained the Queen's own gold. Those who dared cross his boundary line were likely as not to find their waterlogged pockets being fleeced by Mr. Hackman next time the tide dropped. Mr. Swindle was always hounding Sammy to join the mudlarks. He said it was the boy's duty to repay his landlord's charity wherever he could. For though Sammy and Eliza managed to scrape together enough to cover the rent, Mr. Swindle never let them forget that their freedom rested on his willingness not to advise the authorities of their recent change in circumstances. "Them do-gooders what come sniffin' round would be very interested to learn that two young orphans, likes of yourselves, has been left to fend alone in the big old world. Very interested indeed," was his common refrain. "By rights, I should have given you up soon as your ma breathed her last." "Yes, Mr. Swindle," Eliza would say. "Thank you, Mr. Swindle. Very kind of you, it is, too."
"Humph! Don't you go forgetting it, neither. By the goodness of me and my missus's hearts, you're still here."
Then he would look down his quivering nose, and by sole virtue of his mean-spiritedness, set his pupils to narrowing.
"Now if that lad, with his knack for finding things, would find his way into my mud patch, I might be convinced you was worth keeping. Never did meet a lad with a better nose."
It was true. Sammy had a talent for turning up treasures. Ever since he was a tiny boy, pretty things had seemingly gone out of their way to lie at his feet. Mrs. Swindle said it was the idiot's charm, that the Lord looked after fools and madmen, but Eliza knew that wasn't true. Sammy wasn't an idiot. He just saw better than most because he didn't waste his time in talking. Not a word, ever. Not once in all his 12 years. He didn't need to, not with Eliza. She always knew what he was thinking and feeling. Always had. He was her twin, after all. 2 halves of the one whole. That was how she knew he was frightened of the river mud. And although she didn't share his fear, Eliza understood it. The air was different when you got near the water's edge. Something in the mud fumes, the swooping of the birds, the strange sounds that bounced between the ancient banks of the river. Eliza knew also that it was her responsibility to look after Sammy, and not just because Mother had always told her so. It was Mother's inexplicable theory that a bad man, she never said who, was lurking, intent upon finding them. Even when they were very small, Eliza had known that Sammy needed her more than she needed him, even before he caught the fever and was nearly lost to them. Something in his manner left him vulnerable. Other children had known it when they were small. Grown-ups knew it now. They sensed somehow that he was not really one of them. And he wasn't. He was a changeling. Eliza knew all about changelings. She'd read about them in the book of fairy tales that had sat for a time in the rag and bottle shop. There'd been pictures, too. Fairies and sprites who looked just like Sammy, with his fine strawberry hair, long ribbony limbs, and round blue eyes. The way Mother told it, something had set Sammy apart from other children ever since he was a babe, an innocence, a stillness. She used to say that while Eliza had screwed up her little red face and howled for a feeding, Sammy had never cried. He used to lie in his drawer, listening, as if to beautiful music floating on the breeze that no one but he could hear. Eliza had managed to convince her landlords that Sammy shouldn't join the Mudlarks, that he was better off cleaning chimneys for Mr. Suttbourne. There weren't many boys Sammy's age still engaged in sweeping, she reminded them, not since the laws against child sweeps were passed. And there was no one could clean the narrower chimneys over Kensington Way quite like a skinny lad with pointy elbows made just for climbing dark and dusty chutes. Thanks to Sammy, Mr. Suttbourne was always fully booked, and there was much to be said, surely, for regular coins. Even when weighed against the hope that Sammy might pluck something valuable from the mud. Thus far the Swindles had been made to see reason. They liked Sammy's coins, just as they'd happily taken Mother's when she was alive and doing the copywork for Mr. Blackwater. But Eliza wasn't sure how long she could keep them at bay. Mrs. Swindle, in particular, had difficulty seeing beyond her greed and was fond of making veiled threats, muttering about the do-gooders who'd been sniffing about looking for muck to sweep from the streets to the workhouse. Mrs. Swindle had always been afraid of Sammy. She was a sort of person for whom fear was the natural response to that beyond explanation. Eliza had once heard her whispering to Mrs. Barker, the coal whipper's wife, saying she'd heard it from Mrs. Tether, the midwife that delivered the two of them, that Sammy had been born with the cord around his neck. She'd never have made it through the first night, would have breathed his last when he took his first, but for the work of mischief. "'Twas the devil's work," she said. "The boy's mother made a deal with him downstairs. You only had to look at him to know it, the way his eyes stared deep within a person, the stillness in his body, so unlike the other lads his age. Oh, yes, indeed, there was something very wrong with Sammy Makepeace." Such tall tales made Eliza even more fiercely protective of her twin. At night, sometimes, when she lay in bed listening to the Swindles arguing, their little daughter, Hattie, bawling over the top, she liked to imagine dreadful things happening to Mrs. Swindle. That she might fall, by accident, into the fire when she was washing, or slip beneath the mangle and be squeezed to death, or drown in a vat of boiling lard, head first, skinny legs the only part of her that remained to evidence her gruesome end. "Speak of the devil, and she shall appear." Round the corner into Battersea Church Road, shoulder bag fat with spoils, came Mrs. Swindle, home after another profitable day spent hunting little girls with pretty dresses. Eliza pulled herself away from the crack and shimmied along the shelf, used the edge of the chimney to ease herself down. It was Eliza's job to launder the dresses Mrs. Swindle brought home. Sometimes when she was boiling the dresses over the fire, minding not to tear the spider's web lace, Eliza wondered what those little girls thought when they saw Mrs. Swindle waving her confectionery bag at them, the confectionery bag full of shiny bits of coloured glass. Not that the little girls ever got near the bag to know the trick that had been played. No fear. Once she had them alone in the alley, Mrs. Swindle got their pretty dresses off them so fast they didn't have time to scream. They probably had nightmares afterwards, Eliza thought, like the nightmares she had about Sammy stuck up the chimney. She felt sorry for them. Mrs. Swindle on the hunt was a fearful thing indeed, but it was their own fault. They shouldn't be so greedy, always wanting more than they already had. It never ceased to amaze Eliza that little girls born to grand houses and fancy perambulators and lacy frocks should fall victim to Mrs. Swindle for such small price as a bag of boiled sweets. They were lucky all they lost was a dress and some peace of mind. There were worse losses to be had in the dark alleyways of London. Downstairs, the front door slammed. "Where are you then, girl?" The voice came rolling up the stairs, a hot ball of venom. Eliza's heart sank as it hit her. The hunt had not gone well, a fact which boded ill for the inhabitants of No. 35 Battersea Church Road. "Get downstairs and ready the supper, or you'll book yourself a hiding." Eliza hurried down the stairs and into the rag and bottle shop. Her gaze passed quickly over the dim shapes, a collection of bottles and boxes reduced by darkness to geometric oddities. By the counter, one such shape was moving. Mrs. Swindle was bent over like a mud crab rummaging in her bag, sifting through various lace-trimmed dresses.
"Well, don't just stand there gawking like that idiot brother of yours. Get the lantern lit, stupid girl."
"The stew's on the stove, Mrs. Swindle," said Eliza, hurrying to light the gas, "and the dresses are almost dry."
"Should think so, too. Day after day I go out, trying to earn the coin, and all you have to do is get the dresses laundered. Sometimes I think I'd be better off doing it myself. Shove you and your brother out on your ears."
She puffed a nasty sigh and sat in her chair.
"Well, come over here then. Get me shoes off."
While Eliza was knelt on the ground, massaging the narrow boots loose, the door opened again. It was Sammy, black and dusty. Wordlessly, Mrs. Swindle held out her bony hand and beckoned slightly with her fingers. Sammy dug into the pocket at the front of his overalls, pulled out 2 copper coins, and laid them where they were due. Mrs. Swindle eyed them suspiciously before kicking Eliza aside with her sweaty, stockinged foot and hobbling to the money box. With a slant-eyed glance over her shoulder, she pulled the key from the front of her blouse and turned it in the lock. Stacked the new coins atop the others, smacking her lips wetly as she calculated their total. Sammy came to the stove and Eliza fetched a pair of bowls. They never ate with the Swindles. It wasn't right, Mrs. Swindle said, for the two of them to be getting ideas about their being part of the family. They was hired help, after all, more like servants than tenants. Eliza began ladling out their stew, pouring it through the sieve as Mrs. Swindle insisted. It didn't do to waste the meat on a pair of ungrateful wretches.
"You're tired," Eliza whispered. "You started so early this morning."
Sammy shook his head. He didn't like her to worry. Eliza glanced towards Mrs. Swindle, checked her back was still turned, before slipping a small piece of hock into Sammy's bowl. He smiled slightly, warily, his round eyes meeting Eliza's. Seeing him like this, shoulders deflated with the day's heavy labours, face plastered with the soot from rich men's chimneys, grateful for the morsel of leathery meat, made her want to wrap her arms around his small frame and never let him go.
"Well, well, what a pretty picture," Mrs. Swindle said, clapping the money box lid shut. "Poor Mr. Swindle, out in the mud digging for the treasures. What put food in your ungrateful mouths?" She waggled a knobbly finger in Sammy's direction. "While a young lad the likes of you is making free in his house. It ain't right, I tells you, it ain't right at all. When those do-gooders come back, I've a good mind to tell them so."
"Does Mr. Sutbourne have more work for you tomorrow, Sammy?" Eliza spoke quickly. Sammy nodded. "And the day after that?" Another nod.
"That's 2 more coins this week, Mrs. Swindle." Oh, how meek she managed to make her voice. And how little it mattered. "Insolence! How dare you backchat? If it weren't for Mr. Swindle and me, you 2 snivelling worms would be out in your ears, scrubbing floors in the workhouse."
Eliza drew breath. One of the last things Mother had done was to obtain an undertaking from Mrs. Swindle that Sammy and Eliza should be allowed to stay on as tenants for as long as they continued to meet the rent and contribute to the household. "But Mrs. Swindle," Eliza said cautiously, "Mother said you undertook..."
"Undertook! Undertook!"
Angry bubbles of saliva burst in the corners of her mouth.
"I'll give you undertook. I undertook to tan your hide till you can't sit down no longer."
She rose suddenly and reached for a leather strap hanging by the door. Eliza stood firm, though her heart was thumping. Mrs. Swindle stepped forward, then stopped, a cruel tick trembling her lips. Without a word, she turned towards Sammy.
"You," she said, "come over here."
No, Eliza said quickly, gaze darting to Sammy's face. No, I'm sorry, Mrs. Swindle. It was insolent of me. You're right. I'll make it up to you. Tomorrow I'll dust the shop. I'll scrub the front step. I'll muck out the water closet shed and rid the attic of rats.
Yes, Eliza was nodding. All of it.
Mrs. Swindle stretched the strap out straight before her, a horizon of leather. She glanced beneath her eyelashes, from Eliza to Sammy and back. Finally, she released one side of the strap and hooked it again into place by the door. A shower of dizzy relief.
Thank you, Mrs. Swindle.
Hand shaking a little, Eliza passed the bowl of stew to Sammy and picked up the ladle to serve her own.
Stop right there, said Mrs. Swindle.
Eliza looked up.
You, said Mrs. Swindle, pointing at Sammy, clean the new bottles and get them set up on the shelf. There'll be no stew till it's done.
She turned to Eliza. And you, girl, get upstairs and out of my sight. Her thin lips quivered.
You'll go without tonight. I've no intention of feeding a rebellion.
When she was younger, Eliza had liked to imagine that her father would one day appear and rescue them. After Mother and the Ripper, Father the Brave was Eliza's best story. Sometimes, when her eye was sore from being pressed against the bricks, she would lie back on the top shelf and imagine her gallant father. She would tell herself that Mother's account was wrong, that he hadn't really drowned at sea, but had been sent away on an important journey, and would some day return to save them from the Swindles. Though she knew it to be fantasy, no more likely to happen than for fairies and goblins to appear from between the fireplace bricks, the pleasure she took from imagining his return was not dimmed. He would arrive outside the Swindles' house, on a horse, she always thought. Riding the horse, not in a carriage pulled behind, a black horse with a glistening mane and long, muscular legs. And everyone in the street would stop what they were doing and stare at this man, her father, handsome in his black riding costume. Mrs. Swindle, with her miserable, pinched face, would peer over the top of her washing line, over the top of the pretty dresses snatched that morning, and she'd call to Mrs. Barker to come and see all that was happening. And they would know who this was, that it was Eliza and Sammy's father come to rescue them. And he would ride them to the river, where his ship would be waiting, and they'd sail off across the ocean to faraway places with names she'd never heard of. Sometimes, on the rare occasions when Eliza had been able to convince her to join in telling tales, Mother had spoken of the ocean. For she had seen it with her own eyes, and was thus able to furnish her stories with sounds and smells that were magical to Eliza. Crashing waves and salty air, and fine grains of sand, white rather than the slimy black sediment of the river mud. It wasn't often, though, that Mother joined in at story time. For the most part, she disapproved of stories, especially that of Father the Brave. "You must learn to know the difference between tales and truth, my Liza," she would say. "Fairy tales have a habit of ending too soon. They never show what happens afterwards, when the prince and princess ride off the page."
"But what do you mean, Mother?" Eliza would ask.
"What happens to them when they need to find their way in the world, to make money, and escape the world's ills?" Eliza had never understood. It seemed irrelevant, though she wouldn't say as much to Mother. They were princes and princesses. They didn't need to make their way in the world, only as far as their magical castle. "You mustn't wait for someone to rescue you," Mother would continue, a faraway look in her eyes. "A girl expecting rescue never learns to save herself. Even with the means, she'll find her courage wanting." "Don't be like that, Eliza. You must find your courage. Learn to rescue yourself. Never rely on anyone else." Alone in the upstairs room, simmering with loathing for Mrs. Swindle and anger at her own impotence, Eliza crawled inside the disused fireplace. Carefully, slowly, she reached up as high as she could, felt about with an open hand for the loose brick, pulled it clear. In the small cavity beyond, her fingers grazed the familiar top of the small clay mustard pot, its cool surface and rounded edges. Mindful not to send notice of her actions echoing down the chimney and into Mrs. Swindle's waiting ears, Eliza eased it out. The pot had been Mother's, and she'd kept it secret for years. Days before her death, in a rare moment of consciousness, Mother had told Eliza of the hidey hole. She bade her retrieve its contents, and Eliza had done so, brought the clay pot to Mother's bedside, wide-eyed with wonder at the mysterious hidden object. Suspense tingled in Eliza's fingertips as she waited for Mother to fumble the pot open. Her movements were clumsy in the last days, and the pot's lid was held tight by a wax stopper. Finally, it cracked apart from the base. Eliza gasped in amazement. Inside the pot was a brooch, the likes of which would have had Mrs. Swindle weeping warm tears down her horrid face. It was the size of a penny, gems lining the decorative outer rim, red and green and shiny, shiny white. Eliza's first thought was that the brooch had been stolen. She couldn't imagine Mother doing such a thing, but how else had she come to possess such glorious treasure? Where could it have come from? So many questions, and yet she couldn't find her tongue to speak. It wouldn't have mattered if she had. Mother wasn't listening. She was gazing at the brooch with an expression Eliza had never seen before. "This brooch is precious to me," came the tumble of words. "Very precious." Mother thrust the pot into Eliza's hands, almost as if she could no longer bear to touch it. The pot was glazed, smooth and cool beneath her fingers. Eliza didn't know how to respond. The brooch, Mother's strange expression, it was all so sudden.
"Do you know what it is, Eliza?"
"A brooch. I've seen them on the fancy ladies." Mother smiled weakly, and Eliza thought she must have given the wrong answer. "Or perhaps a pendant? Come loose from its chain?"
"You were right the first time. It is a brooch, a special kind of brooch." She pressed her hands together. "Do you know what is behind the glass?"
Eliza looked at the pattern of red gold threads. "A tapestry?"
Mother smiled again. "In a way it is, though not the sort formed of threads."
"But I can see the threads plaited together to form a rope."
"They are strands of hair, Eliza, taken from the women in my family. My grandmother's, her mother's before, and so on. It's a tradition. This is called a mourning brooch."
"Because it's worn only in the morning?"
Mother reached out and stroked the end of Eliza's plait. "Because it reminds us of those we've lost, those who came before and made us who we are." Eliza nodded soberly, aware, though she wasn't sure how, of having received a special confidence. "The brooch is worth a lot of money, but I have never been able to bring myself to sell it. I have fallen victim time and again to my sentimentality. But that should not stop you."
"Mother?"
"I am not well, my child. Soon it will fall to you to look after Sammy and yourself. It may become necessary to sell the brooch."
"Oh, no, Mother."
"It may become necessary, and it will be your decision to make. Do not let my reluctance guide you, do you hear?"
"Yes, Mother.
But if you do need to sell it, Eliza, be careful how you do so. It must not be sold officially. There can be no record.
Why not?
Mother looked at her, and Eliza recognized the look. She herself had given it to Sammy many times when deciding how honest to be.
Because my family would find out.
Eliza was silent. Mother's family, along with her past, was rarely spoken of.
They will have reported it stolen.
Eliza's brow shot up. Erroneously, my child, for it is mine. I was given it by my mother on the occasion of my 16th birthday. It was in my family long before that.
But if it's yours, Mother, why can no one know you have it?
Such a sale would reveal our whereabouts, and that cannot happen. She took Eliza's hands, eyes wide, face pale and weak from the effort of speaking.
Do you understand?
Eliza nodded. She understood. That is, she sort of understood. Mother was worried about the bad man, the one she'd been warning them about all their lives, who could be anywhere, lurking behind corners, waiting to catch them. Eliza had always loved the stories, though Mother never went into sufficient detail to assuage her curiosity. It was left to Eliza to embellish Mother's warnings, to give the man a glass eye and a basket of snakes and a lip that curled when he sneered.
"Shall I fetch you some medicine, Mother?"
"Good girl, Eliza. You're a good girl."
Eliza placed the clay pot on the bed beside Mother and fetched the little bottle of laudanum. When she returned, Mother reached out to stroke again the strand of long hair that had unraveled from Eliza's plait.
"Look after Sammy," she said, "and take care yourself. Always remember, with a strong enough will, even the weak can wield great power. You must be brave when I... if anything should happen to me."
"Of course, Mother, but nothing will happen to you."
Eliza didn't believe this, and neither did Mother. Everybody knew what happened to people who got the consumption. Mother managed a sip of medicine, then leaned back against her pillow, exhausted by the effort. Her red hair spread out beside her, revealing her pale neck with its single scar, the fine slice that never faded and had first inspired Eliza's tale of Mother's encounter with the Ripper. Another of the tales she never let Mother hear. With her eyes still closed, Mother spoke softly, in short, fast sentences.
"My Eliza, I say this but once. If he finds you and you need to escape, then... and only then, take down the pot. Don't go to Christie's. Don't go to any of the big auction houses. They have records. Go round the corner and ask at Mr. Baxter's house. He'll tell you how to find Mr. John Picnic. Mr. Picnic will know what to do."
Her eyelids quivered with the strain of so much speech.
"Do you understand?"
Eliza nodded.
"Do you understand?"
"Yes, Mother, I understand."
"Until such time, forget that it exists. Do not touch it. Do not show it to Sammy. Do not tell a soul."
"And, Eliza..."
"Yes, Mother?"
"Always watch for the man of whom I speak."
And Eliza had been good to her word, for the most part. She'd taken the pot down only twice, and then merely to look, to float her fingers over the top of the brooch, just as Mother had done, to feel its magic, its inestimable power, before sealing the lid quickly and carefully with candle wax and stowing it back in place. And though she took it down today, it wasn't to look at Mother's mourning brooch, for Eliza had made her own addition to the clay pot. Inside was her own treasure, her own contingency for the future. She plucked out the little leather pouch and held it tightly in her palm. Drew strength from its solidity. It was a trinket Sammy had found in the street and given her. Some wealthy child's plaything, dropped and forgotten, found and revived. Eliza had kept it hidden from the first. She knew if the Swindles saw it, their eyes would light up and they'd insist on putting it downstairs in the rag and bottle shop. And Eliza wanted the pouch like she'd never wanted anything before. It had been a gift, and it was hers. There weren't many things she could say that about. It was some weeks before she finally found a use for it, as a hiding place for her secret coins, the ones the Swindles knew nothing about, paid to her by Matthew Roden, the rat-catcher. Eliza had a skill for rat-catching, though she didn't like to do it. The rats were just trying to stay alive, after all, best as they could in a city that favoured neither the meek nor the mild. She tried not to think about what Mother would say. She'd always had a soft spot for animals. Instead, Eliza reminded herself that she didn't have much choice. If she and Sammy were to stand a chance, they needed coin of their own, secret coin that passed beneath the Swindles' notice. Eliza sat on the edge of the hearth, clay pot on her lap, and dusted her sooty hands on the underside of her dress. It wouldn't do to wipe them where Mrs. Swindle could see. No good would come once her suspicious nose was set to twitching. When Eliza was satisfied her hands were clean, she opened the pouch, loosened the soft silken ribbon, and gently widened the opening. Peeked inside. "Rescue yourself," Mother had said, "and look after Sammy." And that was just what Eliza intended to do. Inside the pouch there were 4 threepenny bits. 2 more, and she'd have enough to buy 50 oranges. That was all they needed to start out as orange sellers. The coins they made would buy more oranges, and then they'd have their own money, their own little business. They'd be free to find a new place to live, where they were safe, without the watchful, vengeful Swindle eyes upon them. The ever-looming threat of being turned over to the do-gooders and sent to the workhouse. Footsteps on the landing. Eliza pushed the coins back into the pouch, tightened its neck, and poked it inside the pot. Heart thumping, she slotted the pot back inside the chimney. It could be sealed later. Just in time, she jumped clear and perched, a model of innocence, on the end of the rickety bed. The door opened and Sammy appeared, still black with soot. Standing in the door frame, single candle flickering limply in his hand, he looked so thin, Eliza thought it a trick of the light. She smiled at him and he came towards her, reached inside his pocket and retrieved a small potato sneaked from Mrs. Swindle's larder. "Sammy," Eliza scolded, taking the soft spud. "You know she counts them. She'll figure it was you that took it." Sammy shrugged, started rinsing his face in the bowl of water by the bed. "Thank you," she said, stashing the potato in her mending basket when he wasn't watching. She'd return it in the morning. "It's getting cold," she said, taking her pinafore off, so she wore only her underdress. "It's early this year." She climbed into bed, shivered beneath the thin grey blanket. Down to his undershirt and shorts, Sammy hopped in beside her. His feet were freezing, and she tried to warm them with her own. "Shall I tell you a story?" She felt his head moving, his hair brushing her cheek as he nodded. And so she launched into her favourite tale. Once upon a time, when the night was cold and dark, and the streets were empty, and her twin babies were pushing and squirming inside her belly, a young princess heard footfalls behind her, knew instantly whose wicked tread they were. She'd been telling it for years, though not when Mother could hear. Mother would have said Eliza was upsetting Sammy with her tall tales. She didn't understand that children aren't frightened by stories, that their lives are full of far more frightening things than those contained in fairy tales. Her brother's shallow breaths had become regular, and Eliza knew that he had fallen asleep. She stopped her story and reached to take his hand in hers. It was so cold, so bony, she felt a flutter of panic in her stomach. She tightened her grasp, listening to him breathe. "Everything will be all right, Sammy," she whispered, thinking of the leather pouch, the money inside. "I'll make sure of it. I promise."
Chapter 15. London, 2005. Ben's daughter Ruby was waiting for Cassandra when she arrived at Heathrow. A plump woman in her late 50s, with a face that glowed and short silver-grey hair that stood to resolute attention. She had an energy that seemed to charge the air around her, the type of person other people noticed. Before Cassandra could express surprise that this stranger was at the airport to greet her, Ruby had seized Cassandra's suitcase, put a fleshy arm around her, and steered them both out through the glass doors of the airport and into the fume-filled car park. Her car was a battered old hatch, its interior suffused with the scent of musk and the chemical approximation of a flower Cassandra couldn't name. When they were both belted in, Ruby plucked a bag of licorice all sorts from her handbag and offered them to Cassandra, who took a striped cube of brown, white, and black. "I'm addicted," said Ruby, popping a pink one into her mouth and tucking it in her cheek. "Seriously addicted. Sometimes I can't finish the one in my mouth fast enough to move on to the next." She chewed fiercely for a moment, then swallowed. "Oh, well, life's too short for moderation, wouldn't you say?" Despite the late hour, the roads were alive with cars. They sped along the nighttime motorway, bow-necked street lamps casting orange glows onto the bitumen below. While Ruby drove quickly, making sharp jabs at the brake only when absolutely necessary, gesticulating and shaking her head at other drivers who dared get in her way, Cassandra stared out the window, mentally tracing the concentric rings of London's architectural movements. She liked to think of cities that way. A drive from edge to centre was like taking a time capsule into the past. The modern airport hotels and wide, smooth arterial roads morphed into pebble-dashed houses, then mansion blocks, then, finally, the dark heart of Victorian terraces. As they drew closer to the centre of London, Cassandra figured she should tell Ruby the name of the hotel she'd booked for the two nights before she left for Cornwall. She fossicked in her bag for the plastic folder in which she was keeping her travel documents. "Ruby," she said, "are we near Holborn?"
"Holborn? No. Other side of town. Why?"
"That's where my hotel is. I can catch a taxi, of course. I don't expect you to drive me all the way." Ruby looked at her just long enough for Cassandra to worry that no one's eyes were on the road.
"Hotel? I don't think so."
She changed gear, braked just in time to avoid collision with a blue van in front.
"You're staying with me. I won't hear otherwise."
"Oh, no," said Cassandra, the flash of blue metal still loud in her mind. "I couldn't. It's too much trouble." She began to relax her grip on the car door handle. "Besides, it's too late to cancel my booking."
"Never too late. I'll do it for you."
Ruby turned to Cassandra again, seatbelt squeezing her large breast so that it almost leapt from her shirt.
"And it's no trouble. I've made up a bed, and I'm looking forward to your visit."
She grinned.
"Dad'd skin me alive if he thought I'd sent you off to a hotel."
When they reached South Kensington, Ruby reversed the car into a minuscule space, and Cassandra held her breath, silenced by admiration of the other woman's lusty confidence.
"Here we are, then."
Ruby plucked the keys from the ignition and gestured towards a white terrace on the other side of the road.
"Home, sweet home."
The flat was tiny. tucked deep within the Edwardian house, up two flights of stairs and behind a yellow door. It had only one bedroom, a little shower recess and toilet, and a kitchenette attached to the sitting room. Ruby had set up the sofa bed for Cassandra. "Only 3-star, I'm afraid," she said. "I'll make it up to you at breakfast." Cassandra glanced uncertainly at the tiny kitchenette, and Ruby laughed so that her lime-green blouse shook. She wiped her eyes. "Oh, Lord, no. I don't mean to cook. Why put oneself through the agony when someone else can do it so much better? I'll take you round the corner to a cafe instead." She flicked the switch on the kettle. "Cuppa?" Cassandra smiled weakly. What she really wanted to do was let her facial muscles relax out of this pleased-to-meet-you smile. It may have been the fact of having been so far above the Earth's surface for such a long time, or just her usual mildly antisocial tendencies, but she was using every ounce of energy to keep up a front of function. A cup of tea would mean at least another 20 minutes of smiling and nodding and, God help her, finding answers to Ruby's constant questions. She thought briefly, with guilty longing, of the hotel room on the other side of town. Then she noticed Ruby was already dunking twin tea bags into twin teacups. Tea'd be great. "Here you are, then," said Ruby, handing Cassandra a steaming cup. She sat down on the other side of the sofa and beamed as a cloud of musk-scented air arranged itself around her. "Don't be shy," she said, indicating the sugar pot. "And while you're at it, you can tell me all about yourself. What a thrill, this house in Cornwall." After Ruby had finally gone to bed, Cassandra tried to sleep. She was tired. Colours, sounds, shapes, all blurred around her, but sleep was elusive. Images and conversations played rapidly across her brain, a never-ending stream of thoughts and feelings tied together by no theme more specific than that they were hers. Nell and Ben, the antique stall, her mother, the plane trip, the airport, Ruby, Eliza Makepeace, and her fairy tales. Finally, she gave up on sleep, pushed back the covers, and climbed off the sofa. Her eyes had adjusted to the dark, so she could make her way to the flat's only window. Its wide ledge jutted out above the radiator, and if Cassandra pushed aside the curtains, she could just fit across it. Back against one thick rendered wall, feet touching the other. She leaned forward onto her knees and looked outside, across the skinny Victorian gardens with their stone walls devoured by ivy, towards the street beyond. Moonlight hummed quietly on the ground below. Although it was almost midnight, London wasn't dark. Cities like London never were, she suspected. Not anymore. The modern world had killed nighttime. Once it must have been very different, a city at the mercy of nature. A city where nightfall turned the streets to pitch and the air to fog. Jack the Ripper's London. That was the London of Eliza Makepeace, the London Cassandra had read about in Nell's notebook, of mist-filled streets and looming horses, glowing lamps that materialized, then vanished again into the fog-laden haze. Looking down onto the narrow cobbled mews behind Ruby's flat, she could imagine them now, ghostly horsemen coaxing their frightened beasts along busy lanes, lanterns